Hi, once again, welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today on the show, it's the Science Forum, our panel of esteemed biologists, chemists, and environmental scientists here to attempt to answer your pressing science questions, and physicists as well. The number to call, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Now, before we get to your calls, and feel free to get in the line. But we also have a special treat for you today. For the first part of the program, we'll take questions from students at the Berkshire Arts and Technology School, also known as BART Charter School in Adams, Massachusetts. Let's get started in a moment here by introducing our panel of experts. John, over to you.
Yeah, John Delano, Associate Dean, College of Arts and Sciences at UAlbany.
I'm Nancy Slack from the Sage Colleges in Troy, a biology department. I'm a plant ecologist.
It's Barbara Brabets from SUNY Cobleskill. I'm a biochemist.
Last and least, Ken Wells, a retired physicist.
All right. Now, and a world traveler, I might add.
Yes.
All right. You're back in the States. Nice to have you here, Ken. Now, remember, we'll take student calls for about the first half of the show, give or take. So if you want to get in the queue now, 1-800-348-2551. You can also post your questions on our social media pages. And I'm glad you asked about those. You can comment at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. Also, you could comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio, or you could tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. That's all one word, obviously. Well, it's great to have everybody back for the Science Forum, a full house today, and we will get to your calls. But let's start the show by welcoming the kids from the BART School, and we'll start off today with our first question. Sydney, are you there?
Yes, I am.
You're up, Sydney.
Yep.
Go ahead.
All right. My question is, what part of DNA controls our personality before we are exposed to outside influences?
Hi, Sydney. That's a very interesting way to ask the question. Are you in 10th grade? That's what it says on my sheet.
Yes, I am.
Okay. Well, what you're asking is how much our personality is controlled by DNA or by heredity, and how it compared to what part of our personality is exposed by that when we're exposed to environmental influences. Is that right?
Yes.
And it used to be that some people didn't think any of it was genetics, but that's not true. And I know that personally because having had three babies, the first one, I thought, oh, I knew all about babies, and the second one was so different from the first day that I didn't give any advice after that. So many of our personality traits are controlled by our DNA, but not in the same way that, say, whether you have blue eyes or brown eyes is controlled. It's not a question of one or two genes controlling this. It's a question of a whole slew of them. But people, fathers and sons, or daughters and mothers, often look alike because of physical characteristics, but they also share personality traits, and I think most people realize that. So some of your personality is right there before you're ever out of the womb, but of course it's very much influenced by what kind of environment you're in after that, whether you're exposed to a lot of people, whether you're in a friendly environment, one in which you can learn things. So I think nobody can say exactly how much, but I think it's a fairly large chunk of personality that is controlled by DNA directly or indirectly.
Barbara, you want to chime in?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I saw a documentary about adopted kids who go looking for their birth parents. And there was this scene where the daughter, who's an adult, walks into the airport to find her father, whom she'd never met before, never seen from day one. He was not a part of her biological mother's life. And that she knew him from the mannerisms that he had, because they were mannerisms that she had, the way he touched his head, the way he wrung his hands together. And you think about personality, and you can get to the point where mannerisms can be conserved within a genetic code. That's really odd to me. But it's very striking that there's so much more in the genome that we haven't yet recognized, even though we've so-called mapped the human genome.
Very interesting.
And that same thing is true with studies they've done about identical twins that have been separated at birth and put into different families. They often have very similar mannerisms, but they also are often quite different, for example, in how they do in school, partly as a result of the environment that they're in.
Sydney, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, too.
Let's have the next victim. Lauren, are you there? Hello, Lauren.
Hi.
Hi, you're on.
I was wondering, what part of the brain would consciousness be a part of?
Well, Sydney, this is Barbara from SUNY Cobleskill. And when we think of consciousness, we kind of think of self-awareness, right? That kind of idea? Being able to tell time, know past from future, be aware of self and others. Is that what you would consider consciousness, Lauren?
Hello.
If you could just define consciousness in your sense of what you mean by consciousness.
Wondering, because humans have this idea that they are separate from the other animal species because we have the ability to be aware of ourselves and think for ourselves and have, like, morals and stuff, whereas animals just work on instinct. Oh. And I was just wondering, is that, like, a real thing, or is there, like, a certain part of the brain that controls the consciousness that we are aware of ourselves?
Sure. Actually, that is an even more interesting question than your original question, because it turns out we really did in biology think we were the supreme being, and there had to be so much different about us because we are who we are, and we can change our environment to what we want it to be, and that's really what makes Homo sapiens Homo sapiens. But consciousness does exist outside of Homo sapien. For example, if you've ever seen video of a monkey in front of a mirror, like an ape in front of a mirror, a chimpanzee, if they spend enough time in front of the mirror, they do realize that it is themselves that they're seeing. They're seeing a reflection. But if you take a cardinal, a bird, not a parrot, but kind of a, sorry, cardinals, dumb bird, and you stick it in front of a mirror that you can watch it, it'll peck the mirror until it's bloody in the bill because it thinks there's another guy horning in on his territory and he's just as beautiful as he is. So consciousness does exist in other animals, and we equate consciousness or this ability to see self as a sign of intelligence. So the most intelligent animals seem to have consciousness.
And you don't have to get as far as chimpanzees, which are also primates like us. If you've had a dog or a cat, you can actually see this very well with your pet. I think everybody who's had a dog has seen the dog even have guilt feelings. I mean, I don't know if we can call that a moral compass, but something similar. And it's very clear, we have a new kitten who's turning into cat, and it's very, very clear to me that this kitten knows itself and also remembers things from quite a long time back that it can apply to other things in its life. So intelligence is present in other animals, and consciousness, of course, is a part of that.
So if we look at other animals which seem to evince consciousness the way we do, is there a part of their brain that's more pronounced versus other animals?
Yes.
And would that be the part of the brain? What part would that be?
Thanks, Ken.
Right. That's the brain piece, and that is the cerebrum. That seems to be where we lock memory to a certain extent and the ability to process thought, and that's where intelligence to that extent of consciousness seems to lie.
Okay. Lauren, thank you very much. We appreciate the call. Let's put Ethan on the line, okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. The first of two Ethans is here. Ethan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
You're on, my friend. Go.
All right. My question is, how is astrology connected to space science?
Aha.
I'm a Capricorn.
and it shows. I mean,
astrology was connected to space science back when we were learning about constellations. Since then, I don't know of any astronomer who puts significant amount of faith in astrology. So it was helpful in mapping the heavens when it was first developing. But since then, I know of no scientist, let alone space scientist, who believes that their life is significantly influenced by the sign they were born under, anything like, or any other star readings that you typically find in astrology. So I'd have to say not much.
John, what do you think?
I agree. Not much.
And how does the zodiac actually tie into space science? Because the zodiac is space science in a sense. So when we say Pisces, right, it's March, late February, early March. So if you're Pisces, the idea was there was a constellation that would rise and be present for that period of the time. So mm-hmm. then you were born under the sign Pisces, like literally under.
Okay.
But I'm a Leo, and if he thought I would roar like a lion, I don't think that was true.
Well, there you have it, Ethan. Thank you very much. And, of course, one underlying influence and connection is that astrology helped to fund all of these great scientists. So, you know, all the kings wanted to know what was going on. And so all of these great discoveries, I think, are somehow connected.
In the medieval times, and even, I think, to the 17th century, there were some people that we would certainly consider astronomers who also did astrology. So it hasn't been separated forever and ever.
All right, Ethan, we're going to take a short break here, and then we'll put the other Ethan on the line. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. For the first part of the program, we're talking to students from the Berkshire Arts and Technology Charter School in Adams, Massachusetts. We'll be back with more of their questions and then yours on Vox Pop.
Thank you.
Support comes from the 1850 House Inn and Tavern, Rosendale, New York, newly renovated boutique hotel in the heart of the Hudson Valley. 12 guest rooms with modern amenities and located close to the rail trail and outdoor activities. The1850house.com. Springfield Museums, presenting Guitar, the Instrument That Rocked the World, through April 21st, and The Beatles, backstage and behind the scenes, through June 2nd. Springfieldmuseums.org. Saratoga Health and Wellness, a fitness facility providing clinically trained nutritionists and exercise psychologists, designing personalized wellness programs. SaratogaHealthandWellness.com. And Maria College, Albany, New York, offering RN Baccalaureate Completion Program, Associate's Degree and Professional Certificate Programs, day, evening, weekend, and online classes, mariacollege.edu. And the Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting Pastoral and Parkland, American Landscape Paintings, with works by George Annis, Winslow Homer, Albert Bierstadt, and more. ArkellMuseum.org.
It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop. Dr. John Delano is with us. He is from the Department of Atmospheric Environmental Sciences and the Chemistry Department at the University of Albany. Barbara Brabitz, Associate Professor of Biochemistry in the Department of Natural Sciences at the State University of New York at Cobleskill. Dr. Nancy Slack, Emeritus Professor of Biology and History of Science at the Sage Colleges. Also, Ken Wells is back with us, a physicist, retired following a 33-plus year career. Must be nice to jet-set around, I'll tell you what. And we've also got questions today in the first part of this program from students at the Berkshire Arts and Technology Charter School in Adams, Massachusetts, and we get back to those. We will have your questions, I promise, coming up in the next segment. And the number to call if you want to get in the queue is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. But back to the students we go, and it's time for another Ethan. Ethan, are you on the line?
Yes. How does gravity make a cart roll down a hill?
That's a really good question, and there are still a tremendous number of scientists trying to figure that out. We know exactly how gravity works, but not what makes it do it. That is to say, if you have a car and you know physics and you know things like the rolling friction and the weight of the car and the angle of the slope and the friction in the axles and so forth, you can say to the inch how far that car is going to go in a certain amount of time. Until, of course, it hits the intersection. But you can't say exactly why. We know that it's masses pulling on things, and that masses, the mass of the Earth, which is enormous, tries to pull things towards its center. So we perceive downwards as anywhere towards the center of the Earth and up as away from the center of the Earth. So that's what it does, but we don't know why or how gravity works. We're getting some clues from things like understanding the Higgs boson, but we don't know how. So this is, scientists don't know everything. There's a lot of things you don't know.
Sacrilege.
And sometimes it seems like the more we learn, the more we realize we do not know yet.
John?
Yeah, it's great. As Dr. Wells just described, we can describe gravity very, very well. We can land a rover on Mars within a few meters of where we want it to be. We can use gravity to do so many great things, but that's a description of gravity, not an explanation of gravity. So science is an exploration.
Yeah.
It's a quest, and that's what makes science so much fun.
Well, I'm sorry we couldn't answer your question, but if you come up with the answer, Ethan, give us a call back, okay?
You can have a seat on the science forum if you answer that question.
Thanks a lot. Let's get Aiden on the line. Aiden, are you with us, or will you be with us? Uh-huh. Aiden. Hello, Aiden.
Yes.
You're on.
Thanks. Well, my question is, what can be done with nanotechnology?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got a lot of SUNYs here at the table, so we're all going to give it a try. A little try. That was my nano joke. All right, so nanotechnology has a lot of applications. And right now, Ray just introduced us as a biologist, as a biochemist, as a physicist, and a chemist. But nanotechnology is a little bit of everything. It's engineering, it's biology, it's chemistry, it's materials science, and it's physics. It's enormously interdisciplinary in its approach, but the basic underlying piece is that it's all nano, things at the small level. So I think eventually it'll be broken out into a bunch of other specialties, not just nanotechnology, because right now it's so new that we can just put it all under the umbrella. But the nanotechnology has already brought you things like your cell phone, for example. Your computer can run so much faster now because of nanotechnology. So a specific is the speed of light helps, and the speed of electrons through a circuit board is determined by a couple of different factors. If we make that circuit board a little thinner, in other words, if we can print a circuit board that only has one or two molecules thickness in certain places, we can get that circuit board to work even more efficiently and therefore produce less heat, use less battery, and be able to compute faster. So think about when you were, Aiden, you're in grade 8. So say 13 years ago, a slow computer or a fast computer is pretty slow by today's standards. And those gains in technology are brought to you by nanotechnology. Mm-hmm. But there's medical. That's really big. That's where I see this coming. For example, GE is working on an idea where they can use quantum dots. This is a super idea where you can shine light on a laser on a dot, and that dot will emit light. Will emit energy and kind of like molecularly kill anything near it. So if you think of like cancer treatments, if you could place these dots specifically on a cell surface, like a cancer cell, but not on a regular cell, and then zap it with light, the cancer cell dies. No side effects, no bad chemo, no hair falling out.
Wow.
That's the kind of stuff the nanotech is going to bring you.
Brilliant.
Yeah, packing more capability into less space is one broad description of nano. The medical applications are ginormous that are being worked on now. Nanoparticles that can be vectored to particular proteins or anomalies and have an enormous effect. Still in the horizon, but stay tuned. There's an awful lot going on.
It's the Science Forum on WAMC, and we're taking calls and questions from students at the Berkshire Arts and Technology Charter School in Adams, Massachusetts. Aiden, if you wouldn't mind putting Sage on the line, we'd appreciate it.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. It's like dialing for dollars. Sage, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hello.
Hi. So my question is, how does carbon dating work?
Yeah, the way the carbon dating works is... Sage, by cosmic rays slamming from space, slamming into the atmosphere and making a radioactive carbon isotope, which is carbon-14. Carbon-14 has a half-life, that is the time it takes for half of the atoms of radioactive atoms of carbon-14 to decay. It's 5,730 years. All of us who are carbon-based life have carbon-14 inside us, and it is radioactive and it is ticking.
Now, we should mention that when the cosmic rays come in, the carbon they're affecting most is the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and
that's right.
That, and, that that then gets into your body.
That's right. So that carbon gets into organics.
Into any living thing.
Into any living thing. So when we eat food, which is carbon, it contains carbon-14 that was in the environment, and we ingest it, and that becomes part of us. And when an organism dies, it is no longer taking in that radioactive carbon-14, and that carbon-14 is decaying slowly, half of it gone in 5,730 years. And if you take a sample, measure the carbon-14 and the nitrogen isotope that it decays to, in the sample, you can get an age.
How accurate is that age?
It varies with, the accuracy varies. But currently, confidence levels at a few percent, going back as far as about 20,000 years.
But there are other techniques with isotopes for longer, for dates that are farther back.
Yes.
Okay.
But they're carbon-14 has proved very, very useful for all kinds of dating, but also for understanding how processes work within organisms, you know, how plants do photosynthesis, for example. I mean, that's been going on for quite a long time using carbon-14, but before that, there really were no good tracers of that sort to follow what goes on in life.
So for rocks, we can't use carbon-14 because carbon never gets eaten by rocks, but we can look at other radioisotopes with a much longer half-life. And same idea, just a different part of the periodic table.
All right, Sage, thank you very much for the call. Can we talk to Cameron?
Yep, thank you.
Thank you. Hello, Cameron, are you there?
Yep.
You're on.
Mm-hmm.
So, go ahead.
My question is, what is the evolutionary story of the horse?
Well, I want to know if you've heard about one in school.
Have yeah.
Because sometimes, I don't know what they're teaching right now, but it used to be that one looked at a whole group of fossil horses and you said this little one turned into this middle-sized one and eventually got into a larger one, like a sort of straight line of horses lined up together and getting larger and getting different teeth. That's not really true. The evolutionary history of the horse, although certainly has occurred and well documented by fossils, but it turned out that different aspects of the horse's teeth and the horse's hooves, changed, the length of the head, all changed, but they changed in many different directions, and some of the horses that we have fossils of don't exist at all now, and we're left with horses that are very different from the original ones, the result of this evolutionary process, but you shouldn't look at it as just one straight line.
Mm-hmm.
And to learn more about evolution in general, take a look at the following website, timetree.org. Yeah, great.
Timetree.org.
Correct. Done by Penn State and NASA and the National Science Foundation have funded this. Genomes are connected across thousands of different species. And you plug in, for example, horse and deer. When did they have a last common ancestor?
Mm.
Answer, 82 million years ago, they had a last common ancestor. They wouldn't have looked like a deer and they wouldn't have looked like a horse, but they had a common ancestor about 82 million years ago. And you can put in whales and cats and all sorts of things.
Sounds like we've got a drinking game here that we can.
I think so.
Yeah, that's great.
Just one more. Can I do one more thing,
sure.
Ray? Cameron, when you're talking about evolutionary story, too, in the past, we've used like classical fossil discoveries to really base our evolutionary story. But what John's talking about is a genetic evolutionary chain, which is new because it's all about this DNA and the genome thing. So some of these stories are being rewritten weekly in our scientific journals, and we're having to completely change what the story is because we can't justify our previous story with what we see in front of us with today's science.
Okay.
And actually, it could be a combination because very likely they get DNA out of horses, fossil horses' teeth. So it's a very exciting field.
Well, that is exciting. Cameron, thanks a lot. Did that help?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Let's put Jake on, okay?
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Jake, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Jake, you are on the air.
Okay. My question is, how is hydrofracking expected to work as well with all of the setbacks that we have with it?
What sort of setbacks are you talking about?
Setbacks like with how much water we have to use in order to make the wells, with how it could cause earthquakes to be with it, groundwater contamination.
Okay, so all of the problems that we see with it that make it a negative thing. Now, in it, what you get out of hydrofracking, of course, is natural gas, a lot of it. And in some cases, you also get petroleum. The same process is used for freeing up petroleum reserves. But so there's two sides of this equation. One is the things that can go wrong, or the things that are bad, like the things that can go wrong, that contaminate the water. Things that are bad are how much water it absorbs. It requires. If you're in the middle of the desert, you're not going to be easily doing hydrofracking. The good part is how much energy you get out of it and how much value that energy has to society. Right now, it is the case that we get a lot more value out of the gas we get from hydrofracking than the negative things going into it. A lot of those negative things can be controlled. So, for example, if you properly drill a well and you put all the casings on and you don't skip any steps, and you are careful with how you do all the pumping of water and the additives to the water into the well, then it's safe. If you skip those steps, it's not safe. So how is it expected to work? It'll work any place where there's a positive gain from getting that energy. If we're in an energy-poor economy and we need energy to get going, we have a choice. We could burn coal or we could hydrofrack. In the case of looking at what I want for my grandchildren and their children, I would rather that they hydrofrack, because the downside of putting more coal in the air is just terrible.
But as Ken says, we need safeguards against the people who aren't following all the steps. In that sense, we need the EPA and other organizations to put in really good rules and to watch out for what happens, because Pennsylvania has had just the opposite experience and has made very many people in New York really worried about doing hydropacking here.
Almost any science can be done badly.
Yeah.
Jake, thanks a lot. Now, Ken, one question, though, following up on Jake's question. What about the sheer volume of water needed? In other words, water being obviously a very precious commodity, more or less, depending on where you are in the world. What about the volume of water needed to do hydrofracking? Can you reuse it? Can you clean it? Can you detoxify it?
Yes, to all of those you can, but there's a certain amount that's lost. So, as I say, in a very arid place, in the middle of the desert, you're not likely to make hydrofracking a good commercial venture. In the Northeast, where there's a tremendous amount of water, and we've got lots of rivers that don't suffer droughts, then it's the volume is not a big problem.
Okay. Jake, thanks a lot. Let's put Cassidy on, okay?
Yep. Thank you.
You bet. Hello, Cassidy. Are you with us?
Yeah.
You're on.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, how far does a person need to be from hydrofracking in order to be safe?
From a good hydrofracking facility that's running it safely, you can be right next door.
But from one that isn't running it safely, if there's groundwater that's contaminated, you could be a long distance away.
And by long distance, what do you mean? 50 miles? 100 miles? What? Like, how far does it go?
Good question.
What I mean is, like, how far away do you have to be? Like, because I know that your water can be contaminated. So how far away do you have to be in order for your water to not get contaminated?
It's a really difficult question, because what's underground is not homogeneous. It's not just a big sponge. There are things in the way. We call them aquicludes that separate one underground reservoir of water from another one. The idea in hydrofracking is that you go below an aquiclude to a confined layer of water, and that's where you would do the fracking. The problem is, these confined layers got water because they had some perforations in them to begin with. So the idea is they do leak. They just don't leak that fast. Hmm. So it's like playing darts, where the dartboard is in the dark and you're throwing it. You're hoping you hit a bullseye, but you don't really know what you get until you turn the lights on.
All right.
Okay.
Cassidy, thank you very much. Let's put Raja on, okay?
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. And Raja, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, you're on the air with the scientists. Go ahead.
Okay, my question is, can renewable energy take the place of fossil fuels in this country?
Good question.
The answer is, Raja, yes. It can. It will take a substantial investment and a real interest in doing so. But my family's home has invested a lot in renewable energies for solar hot water and also for solar electricity. Our home, for example, 6 months a year, our electricity bill for 6 months a year is $3 a month. $3 a month.
So it can be done.
It can be done and on a large scale, and it would create jobs and technology and investment and all sorts of things. So I think that the answer could be yes.
But it also takes more science and technology in the future, in my view, because you have to get the cost of those solar panels down.
Or so that wind or whatever.
Whatever we're using. But I think particularly solar energy. Ken might have some different idea here.
Well, if you want to be really strict in your speech, all the energy we're using now is renewable. It just takes millions of years to renew it. But yes, we can. Everything that's been created in millions of years, like oil, we can create today from renewable energy sources, from solar energy sources. There's enough incoming solar energy to the U.S. to take care of all of our energy needs right now at the rate we're using energy.
Okay. Well, you know, does that mean at some point then it would be wiser for everybody to be off the grid if we're going to go all solar or all wind? In other words, you cut the middleman and you generate your own electricity or heat.
No, not necessarily at all. No. The grid has a lot of good uses. Yes. For example, if I wanted to run my house off solar power 100%, I'd have to have an enormous solar panel to make use in the winter. And I have to have a lot of batteries for overnight and for long cloudless weeks. But if I'm connected to the grid, if I have a lot of extra solar energy coming in, I can send it out to somebody else who doesn't need it. So the grid is a good thing. Wow. You don't want to get rid of the grid.
It's a commune.
Very good point.
All right. Hey, very, very big round of applause for our friends at the Berkshire Arts and Technology Charter School. You kids all did a great job, and we thank you guys. For being with us on Vox Pop today, the Science Forum. I'll tell you what. Now's your chance to get in line. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Last third of the program dedicated to you at home. Give us a call.
Support comes from Little Wolf Architecture, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, providing collaborative discovery and design for dwellings in the regional landscape, featuring passive house and natural home strategies. LittleWolfARCH.com. Charles Padula DDS, Union Avenue, Schenectady, featuring new dental technology, including implants and computer-aided local anesthesia. PadulaDDS.com. Don Muller Gallery, Northampton, Massachusetts, hosting its annual bridal jewelry show featuring engagement rings and wedding bands April 6th and 7th. DonMullerGallery.com. And Richards Fuel and Heating, East Hampton, Massachusetts, providing high-efficiency gas and oil heating systems to the Pioneer Valley for over 45 years, now expanding into the Westfield area. RichardsFuel.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, a couple Facebook questions. Jonathan says, I'd like to hear the scientists comment on the current status of climate change. What is necessary for the government to do in order to avert catastrophes such as the rise in ocean levels very quickly so we can get to the phones?
Not possible to do it in the amount of time we have.
Oh boy, that doesn't sound good.
Both literally and figuratively when it comes to climate change.
Okay. All right, so Will on Facebook says, I understand that NASA's Curiosity recently encountered a rock nicknamed Tintina that, when run over by the rover, revealed a white face that seems to have scientists excited. Could you explain the significance of the white rock face? I have not heard about this. John?
Yes, it's a water-deposited vein of sulfate, some kind of a calcium sulfate, most likely. So water percolated through the Martian rock, and that's important. a near neutral pH water fluid deposited that mineral, and that's important.
And so as you search for life, this is a clue that says maybe at one point there was some?
Not that far. It just means that the kind of water that would be conducive to supporting life as we know it would have been present.
You're a very careful scientist. Let's go to Lewis in Woodstock. Lewis, you're on.
Hey, how you doing, guys? Listen, heard you mention somebody said something about throwing a dart at a board, maybe hitting it. How about Russian roulette for that faxing. However, let me ask you this. We've got gas in the ground. How many different ways do you gentlemen know, or any of you know?
Ladies as well.
And sweet ladies, to get the gas out of the ground without the fracking. Nobody's talking about the alternatives.
All right.
Well, first, let's go back to the basics. What is the purpose of fracking? Fracking makes the ground more porous so that a well produces gas faster, okay? So other ways to get natural gas out of the ground is to drill a lot more wells, cost more money, okay? And just have them pump slower. The other things would be to find a place where there's more porous rock and drill into that. That's what we've been doing now for 100 years. And a third way is to make the ground more porous through something other than fracking. So it would be technically possible, if you drill deep enough into a natural gas deposit, to send down a small nuclear explosive.
Oh,
not that we would do that, but it would perforate the ground for a long ways around and allow a lot of natural gas to escape. Not that you'd want to use that gas.
Wow, Ken. This vacation has done you
Hello?
Well.
Hello, am I still on?
You are.
Oh, great. Okay, forget the idea of nuking it, okay? Yeah, I mean, that was just silly. You could use some kind of bombs. You got nitre. You got things that people have been using for explosives and mines for years and years and years. And you could be getting tons of gas out without fracking and without anything negative. You already said that it could be done, that it has been done. So how about doing it instead of just talking about do we want fracking or not, and do we want the gas? Yes, we want the gas, but let's do it. Let's have better drills. Let's have more efficient drills. Let's have more efficient drilling. It can be done. Can it not?
Thanks, Lewis. We appreciate it. Can it be done?
Yes. I mean, we're not just depending on fracking as the only way to improve the output of our wells. The energy companies are constantly looking at better ways to drill and cheaper ways to drill with the same effectiveness. And, it's a science. Right now, the real problem is we use energy at such a prodigious rate that we're resorting to more and more, you might call them desperate measures or higher efficiency measures to get the energy that we need, whether it's from hydrofracking or tar sands.
Right. So it's like a junkie looking for a fix, bigger and bigger all the time.
Well, here's the stat that really resonates with me. We're 5% of the world's population. We use 20% of the annual energy.
Okay. Ed in Salt Point. Ed, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call. Back when you were talking with the students, not sure, was it John who addressed the question about fracking with the student?
I believe Ken, but go ahead.
It was Ken. Okay, fine. And Ken approached it as a cost-benefit analysis, and the student was listing some negative externalities, and the message was, well, if you're just careful about it. And, of course, the response to that is nobody. There's one law besides gravity. Nobody's repealed. It's Murphy's Law.
You're absolutely right.
Yep.
That's good, Ed.
But the folks, my question is, in listing those externalities, there was no reference to what is contended. I'm not a climate scientist at all. But what is contended that fracking, can contribute to climate change, and that has to be taken into the equation. That's a long-term externality.
All right.
Sort of like putting lead in gasoline because it's the cheapest thing to do, and then finding out many years later that we're seeing the people in the hospital. So I'd like, is the reason Ken did not address the climate change externalities on fracking that he doesn't really think they are there? Or
no, I actually did tell you something about that, although I didn't call it out directly as climate change. If we absolutely have to have energy And if the choice, which is this, and this is a very real choice in the U.S. right now, the choice is between making our electricity with natural gas from fracking or making it from coal-fired generators. It's much better for climate change. It's still bad for it, but it's not nearly as bad for it. To do it with hydrofracking is much better than to do it with coal. So, yeah, we do have to worry about climate change, and eventually we have to get to the point where we're not using fossil fuels.
All right, Ed, thanks a lot for the call. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. Somebody else want to jump in here?
Yeah, just that any combustion whatsoever is going to produce carbon dioxide, and natural gas in and of itself, methane, is a greenhouse gas, even if it's not burned. So as it escapes from our peat bogs or our wetlands or the thawing Arctic, it will also contribute to global climate change.
Bob in Clifton Park, you're on Vox Pop. Hi, Bob.
Good afternoon. Often when we hear a weather forecast in anticipation of a big storm coming to this area, they're talking about merger of two storms, with one heading from the west or midwest and one coming up the Atlantic coast. And there's mention of transfer of energy from the eastbound storm to the one that's heading up the coast. What is that energy and how is it transferred?
We don't have a meteorologist here anymore, but a couple of just interesting points from a thermodynamic standpoint. You have low pressure and high pressure. And low pressure is essentially the lack of air pressure. I mean, low pressure sounds like exactly what it is. And high pressure is more air in that area. And of course, they have a mass. And because they have a mass and we have gravity, back to our other call, and that mass is pulled towards the center of the Earth, that creates pressure. So when we have lows that have highs associated with them, the lows tend to be behind because we've had a pocket of high pressure, and then the low pressure follows behind. So that's why it's always cyclic. You know, you get this kind of low pressure, high pressure business. When we have two deficits, that is two areas of low pressure that are merging, then that means we have two pockets of no air. So we're going to get a heck of a wind, right? And wind brings moisture in this area of the world because we have oceans. So that's my very simplistic kind of kindergarten meteorologist translation of thermodynamics as best as I can. Anybody else?
I'm going to take that as homework because I realize that I have a lot of opinions as to what this energy transfer is, but I don't know. And so next time I'm on, I will have researched this and try to come up with a cogent, easily understood answer to what these meteorologists are telling us.
All right, Bob. Well, now you've set out the homework. Congratulations.
Oh, great. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much. Let's go to Paul in Albany. Paul, you're on.
Oh, yeah.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I have been hearing a lot about lifter reactors that use thorium instead of uranium.
Right.
I was wondering if you guys knew about them, and from what I've watched, they look like they're like utopian. They're absolutely perfect. So I was wondering what's good and what's bad about them.
They're absolutely perfect on paper, okay? And that's what's good about them. What's good about them is that they produce very short-lived radioactive waste. And they don't, one of the most important things is they do not produce the kind of fuels you can make hydrogen bombs out of. Okay, or triggers for hydrogen bombs, nuclear bombs. The bad part is there's really only one or two that are running in their research reactors, okay? We have a well-understood and controlled method of building uranium reactors. We've had a tremendous amount of trouble getting to where we are, and it would require enormous amounts of money to change over from a uranium reactor that we understand well to a thorium reactor, which is a molten salt reactor and which requires chemical processing of hot radioactive fuel and fissile material and fertile material. So do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, but as you also know, thorium is much more abundant in the Earth's crust by about a factor of three. It's three times more thorium in the crust than uranium. So for that reason, as Paul's pointing out, it has advantages.
Okay. Paul, thanks a lot. Now, is the actual reaction, is it as efficient as a uranium fission reactor? In other words, will we get the same amount of energy
per gram of material going in. It's for the same amount of work, we should get about the same amount of energy. But one of the things is this uses up waste uranium from old reactors. That's part of the fuel to it.
Yeah.
You actually put some of that in and it converts it.
Well, that's a good thing, right?
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
So the fuel, the thorium's available, the used uranium's available, the energy out is very significant. The efficiency, I can't say to within a percent, but it's very similar in terms of the amount of work that goes into mining the thorium. I cannot tell you exactly because we haven't got commercial reactors doing this yet.
Now, the one or two research reactors you mentioned, there's some serious work being done on these, correct?
Yes, and there's a lot of papers and research going on this in universities and throughout the scientific community. But this is a long ways off. It might be a really good idea, but it might also be a long ways off.
Okay. Well, I guess you have to start somewhere. Let's go to Jack in Kingston. Jack, you're on the Vox Pop Science Forum.
Hello. Do you believe that the government has said that if all refrigerators were upgraded and all the older ones over the 10 years were done away with, trash, that we would not have to build any more reactors or utility companies, that tremendous amount of electricity would be saved? Do you believe that?
It wasn't the government that said that. It was the other Science Forum panel. And if you do the math is correct. Refrigerators, old refrigerators, let me put it that way. You know, say you get a new fridge because your old fridge is dying. Most people put the old fridge in the garage and throw some beer in it, right? The idea is to actually get them out of service because they are complete energy hogs. And there's been an enormous amount of efficiency built into the newer refrigerator. So if your refrigerator is less than 10 years old, then you're conserving electricity. If it's more than 10 years old and you can afford it, get rid of it and get a new one.
Don't you think that the government ought to somehow support the exchange of one refrigerator for another?
They should buy me a new refrigerator.
I traded in my old chest freezer and got $30 from National Grid. So there was a program in place for me to do this. Hmm. And yes, so they do. In fact, if I don't know if that's a government subsidy or it's just a NYPERG subsidy. But one of the things we should point out is that while this works one time for some period of time, what it's saying is we're saving enough energy that we don't have to build new reactors. Well, wouldn't we get to take some offline? No, because we're constantly using more electricity for other things. So it would help balance out our growth in consumption for a while, maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years. But after that, you can't play that trick again because there's not enough efficiency left to pull out of refrigerators. Now you have to take it out of something else.
Okay, let's go to Vane and Beacon. Vane, you're on.
Hi, I'm a proponent of deep geothermal energy. I've been studying it since the MIT report came out in 2007, which just compared it to everything else and says it's the best. But what I'm asking is why doesn't the science of drilling approach better drilling to the unlimited supply of energy 10 miles from everywhere on Earth? It's what it takes is a research project to figure out how to go deep. And model it and then spread it around. It makes so much sense to me, and I just wonder why it doesn't make sense to others.
Economics, probably.
It's economics, but also there's changes in geology around the world, too. And there are places where drilling down for geothermal is so easy. Think of the Ring of Fire in the Asian Basin, and then not so much like here. So, yes, you can do geothermal for your house here. You don't have to go 10 miles down for it. But if you're looking at massive commercial operations, there are parts of the world that are just not economically viable. But if you look at a global market, we can study the geology of the planet, as they did at MIT, and say, hey, let's do it here, here, and here. And see what we get.
And that's being done, actually, in Iceland and other places.
Yes.
Well, of course. I was talking about is the actual research to make it so that it's possible here in New York instead of just in California and Iceland.
Okay. Yeah? Anybody?
It's just drilling. That's it.
That's right.
All right.
That's it.
Drill, baby, drill. All right. Tell you what, Don, you have about 20 seconds. I apologize, but we are out of time. Go ahead, real quick.
Yes, good afternoon. Everyone talking about the energy crisis, even when we're talking about
they call alternative sources of energy, they seem to limit themselves to solar, wind, geothermal, hydropower, wave action, tidal action. But there are other ways we could generate constant energy if we just apply a few of the basic laws of physics. And I think you're going to see some of these things developing in the near future. And everyone seems to be stuck on the old mode of producing energy. Burn it up, blow it up, chemicalize it up, and you're just causing more problems in those areas.
And Don, unfortunately, time is up. So thanks a lot, my friend. And thanks to all the scientists who were here, Ken, Barbara, Nancy, and John. And thanks to the kids at the BART School in Adams, Massachusetts. Support comes from Mario's True Value Home Center, Valencia, featuring a new kitchen and bath design center offering Star Mark cabinetry, Cambria, and more. True Value Start Right, Start Here, mariostruevalue.com. Carrie Haddad Gallery, Hudson, New York, presenting Dale Payson's Still Lives and Fancy's Ceramics and Works, Francie's Ceramics and Works by Jenny Kemp, now through April 14th. CarrieHaddadGallery.com. Bel Air Mountain Ski Center, now managed by the New York State Olympic Regional Development Authority, New York's winter snow park, belair.com. And Stories Nursery, Freehold, New York, a gardener's destination featuring Palm Sunday Flower Show, Easter lilies, tulips, and more. Open Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., Sundays 9 to 4, storiesnursery.com. Well, thanks to all who called in. Thanks to the kids at the school. Thanks to our scientists. Good show today. Thanks to engineer Zach Malloy for his usual sterling service. Colleen O'Connell for doing double duty this week, answering the phones yet again today. Our producer is Patrick Donges. I'm Ray Graff. Moyers & Company tomorrow at this time. On Monday, it's Medical Monday. Bob Barrett will host the show. Alan's away. Eric Plakin will be his guest to talk about mental health issues. Stay tuned now for a news update.